You're listening to the Kick-Ass Life Podcast with David Wood.
Relationships. Health. Finance.
Fun.
Adventure.
Love.
Want to make your life better?
This is the Kick-Ass Life Podcast with David Wood.
Hello again. Here we are. Looking forward to it. This is going to be a cool one. You know, as you probably know, I do some podcasts with a guest and some I write solo. This is a solo. You know, I'm getting some questions on Facebook. Yeah, people are asking. So I want to address some of those and what's going on? What's going on with me right now? You know, having some interesting times with my kids. You know, they're just going through those teenage years, 14 and 12. And I've always said, you know, my kids have been my greatest teacher. And they certainly have. It's just a remarkable journey. And of course, I often joke, I wish it came with a sort of an owner's manual. Yeah, one of the things I stopped doing a long time ago was judging how other parents raise kids. You know, before I had kids, oh yeah, I'd look over and think, look at the way that's going. Ho, 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 ho. Like I knew something. It's always people that don't have kids that say things like that. So you people without kids out there, stop it. You have no idea. You wait till you got two of your own and then you start pointing fingers. Yeah. Oh dear, I used to do that. I was terrible. So, but you know, yeah, it's interesting. You know, I sort of mentioned on the last podcast that, you know, my kids are pretty plugged in. You know, I mean, they have to be this day and age. You know, and I look at how I was as a kid and the sort of the journey, how I looked at my parents as being out of touch, fuddy-duddies, you know, didn't understand my generation, blah, 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 right? And then I look at, you know, the 60s, you know, where I was born in 61, but that whole flower power sort of era where people was, you know, free love, you know, drugs and Woodstock and all these other great things, you know, but that was, again, that rebellion against parenting, rebellion against the establishment, you know, and it's interesting as I look back and really look back with an open heart, open mind to see, you know, what each generation has fought against. How they've sort of expanded into their own way of expression. You know, Bob Dylan, you know, when you listen to all of his songs, that whole era, actually, a lot of the songs were really sort of against the parents, against what was going on. You know, and then I look at this generation, you know, I hear parents, myself, I'm 51, myself included sometimes, oh, it's not like they used to be. Kids used to run around, la, 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 you know. And yeah, they did, but, you know, it's a different world, and it's a different world when I was growing up. I was very different from my parents' thinking. And imagine if we were all doing what our grandparents were doing, where, you know, we went out to work, the guys went out early in the morning, came home late, didn't speak to the kids, smacked them around a little bit, you know, the wife cooked, you know. That's not the world we live in, and thank goodness for that. But, you know, watching how kids communicate is really interesting because, you know, they have their own language through text. It's a very different way of expressing, and we're all fearful. I hear it in so many parents that, you know, the world is changing and the art of connection and communication. I teach so much around the art of connection, about bringing people together authentically and teaching them how to communicate. So I know this generation, I've trained tens of thousands probably of people around just that one thing, the art of connection, bringing people in and teaching them how to connect with each other. So here we are thinking we have an understanding of that. But truthfully, I mean, if you look at how parents are, And people who are in their, you know, 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s, you know, most people walk around with blinkers on anyway. You know, they're sort of, you know, they're not connecting as they walk down the street. You know, that old saying before, you know, that it takes a village to raise a child. You know, that doesn't exist much anymore. I mean, there's pockets of that, and there are certainly cultures like that still around the world where you'll see whole villages, you know, that are embedded in a child's life. I think that the majority of people, they lock their doors at night and they put their TV on. And I have to teach 40, 50-year-old people, 60-year-old people how to talk to each other, how to have authentic conversations, how to really connect. So here we are pointing fingers at this young generation like they're missing something. The difference, I think, is, you know, these kids are connected in a way where, and again, whether I like it or not, I'm not a very technological kind of guy. Here I am running a podcast, and I'm looking at all these buttons and going, holy, you know, and I'm sitting here alone now in my studio. And it's funny, I have a bobblehead of Steve Jobs looking right at me in the eye right now. It's a really cool one. It looks just like him. Apparently they were banned because they weren't sanctioned by Apple. But so here I got Steve Jobs watching me right now. So if I'm feeling a little nervous. But getting back to what I was saying, you know, it's a crazy thing, you know, how we look at our kids as if they don't know, and we do know. And it's really interesting. What I love is how, you know, I know people quite well, you know, and they were, you know, they were out partying and doing their thing, and, you know, they were anti-establishment with their own parents, and here they are, you know, talking about their kids as if they're not going to go out there and learn their own way of being. And again, I don't have an owner's manual. I do not profess to be an astounding parent. In fact, I started doing this work to become a better dad, you know, and that was really, my marriage was on the rocks, and, you know, my kid was, Cal was only, you know, 3, and I was a bear, you know. I never learned from my own, my father left when I was 7, so I didn't really have that model of what a father should or could be. And so I started this journey of personal growth really to find out more about myself and how I could really become a better father, right? But this is interesting because, you know, right now I got this with my kids, is they're going through that age. There's a lot going on, puberty, and, you know, my son's, you know, he's 6'3" almost, and, you know, he's hairy and got a deep voice, dad, you know, and just a lot going on. And so I don't really have a lot of rules, but one of the rules is about being kind, and another one is being grateful. I know that with kindness and gratitude, you know, so much can happen in the world for someone, you know. And then there's a few other rules, but, you know, that whole idea of gratitude and kindness, if we can just practice that. And so I noticed that he's moved away from that a little bit lately, and so I have got him on a complete ban from all electronics for, I told him it'd probably be a month. But it's holding the course. Now, he has a girlfriend, so I said to him, I said, hey, buddy, I said, I've got 12 acres where I live, you know, and there's a lot of grass to cut. And I said to him the other day, I said, hey, Cal, if you want to cut the grass, I said, I can, one of two things, you can earn an hour on your text machine so you can communicate with your girlfriend, or I'll pay you, you know, I'll pay you to cut the grass, you know, because that's sort of more of a, that's not the stuff. I don't pay him to do stuff around the house, but, you know, something like that, you know, I don't mind paying him for that. And it's a lot of property. It takes 7 hours to cut the grass if you do it all. That's crazy, isn't it? You know, but doing this ban and keeping that steady hand, and you know, he doesn't really resist it when I do. But it's an interesting thing about, you know, where, you know, how to sort of bring that best part out, you know. And I really watched it this last, you know, 4 or 5 days, and just reminding myself, Cal, I'm on your side here. I want you to have these back. I really do. I want you to have these back, and I want you to understand that, you know, kindness and gratitude and participating in the family, you know, and treating each other with respect. These are easy things. This is just one little switch you've got to switch inside your head and realize that, you know, you could be a teenager that rebels. I mean, I hated my parents. Hey, if you're listening, parents, you know it's the truth. But, you know, I was at a point where I just hated my parents at that point, you know. I didn't know my dad at all really at that point, but my mom, you know, I mean, we were like batting heads like crazy. So, I mean, I was in this complete kind of teenage hate, and which I think a lot of parents I've spoken to have gone through that at some point. Of course, they come back, and I don't want that to happen. I want my kids to be friends. And of course, you know, I mean, there's still rules, right? So the balance between sort of setting rules and being friends, you know, again, some of you people out there have raised successful children. And isn't that crazy? That's a crazy thing. You know, I know a lot of, hear about a lot of kids who are valedictorians or, you know, the best in sports at school, you know, who grow up and really don't have successful lives. You know, we're talking about creating a kick-ass life on this whole series, you know, and it doesn't really correlate, or it doesn't seem to correlate. When you look at success in school, doesn't always mean success in life of you know, self-worth, self-love. And that's probably one of the things I see most. If I've trained 100, 200,000 students, maybe more, I don't know how many students I've trained, but it's a lot. And I'd say that whole self-worth thing, self-love, seems to be one of the reoccurring themes in almost everyone. And so, you know, when I get back to this sort of how we raise our children and this world that they're growing up in is so different from the world we grew up in. And the way that the kids are communicating is so different. And I really have to force myself to understand that and understand that, you know, if I look back on history and how I was and how I turned out, you know, I everything I could have possibly, everything that could have gone wrong really for me, you know, I didn't do well at school academically, you know, I was in trouble, I was doing drugs, I was drinking, I was doing all these things, I was stealing cars, you know, I was just a badass, you know, and I wasn't leading a kick-ass life, I was a badass. And but it was one of those things where some of that stuff really helped me understand. It really set me up to do the kind of work I do. Because I hear what people say, you know, or being understanding or empathetic or having walked in someone's shoes. What's that great saying? You know, don't judge someone until you've walked in their shoes. You've walked a mile in their shoes. That way you're a mile away and you own their shoes. I shouldn't start telling jokes to myself in the morning. That would be one of the... you know, that one of those crazy things when a guy starts sitting in a room telling jokes to himself, maybe cuckoo, cuckoo. But yeah, so yeah, that's what's going on for me, you know, doing the best I can as a dad. And, you know, my wife and I are separated, but I really, really respect her so much. She's a great, great lady. And it's great to have a relationship. You know, I have a keys to her home and, you know, just be able to wander in. If she's there, I just open the door, walk in, and we've always committed. The only rule we have, it's crazy, we've been separated like 8 years. We still have no divorce papers or anything. We've never gone through that whole process. And I put her on title, and she's put me on title of things we buy because, you know, ultimately it's about the kids. And obviously, if we move on, and we want to get married again, that would be a different kind of kettle of fish. But we haven't gone there yet. So it's interesting, though, to have that sort of friendship where I feel like, you know, the one of the agreements we made in our separation was to always live in the same town. And that was it. That was one of the primary ones that we'd live 10 minutes away from each other so we could raise the kids and be a part of the kids' lives. And, you know, Pam does so much more than I do anyway because I have to travel with my work. I choose to travel. I don't have to travel. I choose to travel. Now, what I love is taking my boys with me when I'm doing programs. And I can't believe they love going. I mean, one of my big programs is called Beyond Courage. And it's 5 days, and it's in the wilderness, and we do like some really exciting stuff. And they've done it twice, you know, and it's great to watch them as a student in the program when they were, Ben did it the first time at 10. And some of it's, you know, you watch parents really quaking in their shoes. So I know it's good for them. So I want them to come. I'm doing a big program in November, December, two programs back to back, and I want them to come to that. So, you know, exposing them to that. And I love it, you know, because they're so different, both my kids, right? Calvin is always at the back of the room, and he doesn't want to be on stage. And Ben is always on stage with me, and he loves being on stage. One wants to be an actor, and, you know, wants to. In the last school play, Calvin was, you know, running the spotlights, and that's kind of so different. So, where am I up to? What are we going to talk about? You know, that's kind of what's going on for me. And I send out some real warm love to all parents. You know, it's challenging, and it's also remarkable. It's wonderful, and it's. You know, it's of course it's everything, and so I'm really excited about the journey. And again, my goal right now is to have that friendship and have the respect. You know, and who knows? We'll see if he gets his electronics back. You know, he'll be like 22. Dad, I think it's time. Are you being kind yet?
No.
Maybe another month, son. Anyway, I love them both. I love them so much. So I want to talk a little bit about leadership in this series, you know, in this podcast right here, and I want to share one of my favorite poems, and it really let it resonate with you. And I've changed the words to personalize it to me in parts of it. You'll hear me talking in the first person because this is really about me, and if you want it to be about you, you can change the words for yourself as well. Our deepest fear is not that we are inadequate. Our deepest fear is that we are powerful beyond measure. It is our light, not our darkness, that most frightens us. We ask ourselves, who am I to be brilliant, gorgeous, talented, fabulous? Actually, who am I not to be? I am a child of the universe. My playing small does not serve the world. There is nothing enlightened about shrinking so that other people won't feel insecure around me. We're all meant to shine as children do. We were born to make manifest the glory of the universe that's within us. And it's not just in some of us, it's in everyone. As I let my own light shine, I unconsciously give other people permission to do the same. As I am liberated from my own fear, my presence automatically liberates others. Yeah, I love that. But you know, the kick-ass life, right? What does it mean? And a lot of why I do this? Because so much of what I do is about authenticity and showing up and removing the mask and being who you were born to be, as opposed to who you were learned to be. And that wonderful line there, you know, as I let my own light shine, I unconsciously give other people permission to do the same. As I am liberated from my own fear, my presence automatically liberates others. So that's that real kind of thing, the theme I think of what it is to be kick-ass, is to really show up in that authentic way. Now, I thought what I'd share today, we have a couple of questions up on Facebook I want to address. A friend of mine, Sue Field, who's been a student at a lot of my programs, her and a lovely husband, Glenn, and their two incredible daughters, are very loyal followers of what I do. So thanks, and I'll answer your question. I just see it up there on Facebook right now. And I want to remind people, I'm going to sort of post when I'm chatting with people. I'm going to post who I'm yakking to, so you can get involved in some of the questions I ask, you know. And I don't write questions down, to be honest with you. I mean, I listen to people, and it's a conversation, and hopefully you enjoy it. But there's a research team. They conducted a survey of 10,000 individuals, and they asked them, they said, what is it that the most influential leaders contribute to their life? So there's 10,000 people. This is a Gallup poll. What do the most influential leaders contribute to your lives? What attributes or characteristics are the most important in the leaders that you follow? All right. So those two things. What are the most influential leaders contributing? And what are the attributes and characteristics that are most important in the leaders that you follow? And I think, you know, it doesn't matter whether you're at home right now and you're not leading a company. I think leadership is something we all want. And whether we're at the PTA or wherever we are, there's things that we can do. And these leadership qualities, what I love about the answers of these 10,000 person survey was that they were things that absolutely surprising, because, you know, you look at Maxwell's work on leadership and all the great leaders, you know, the success principles with Jack Canfield and all these different things. There's a lot of practical leadership skills that we have to learn. But these ones are such human things that I'm thinking, you know, you do these well. You're a kick-ass leader, because there are things that we can all do. And one of them, the one of the four things that they found, and I'm going to talk about the four things that were found and then a few that I've added that I think are important that are along the human quadrant, right? So the first one was stability. Stability. And when I thought about that, I thought, stability, that's interesting. You know, they do these 10,000 people survey about what they're looking for in a leader, and stability is one of them. And I suppose that's true for me, right? I mean, what do I want? I want to be around friends that are stable. I want my relationship. One of the big defining factors of my relationship is consistency. I don't want to come home and, you know, one day I'm a complete bear and the other day I'm really happy. I want it to be more of a consistent kind of a feeling where there's a joy of being together. But I was thinking, who do I know in the world who's a great leader that really exemplifies this quality? And I want to give you, let me see, I'll do a little test, see if you can guess this one. This person I was thinking about, he filed his first income tax return at the age of 14, and he took a $35 deduction for the use of his bicycle and watch on his paper route. So I'll give you a second to guess. Any guesses? Well, I think of Warren Buffett. When I think of stability, you got this, you know, the Oracle from Omaha, you know, this guy who just lives in the same house he's lived in for 40 or 50 years, very modest, and, you know, one of the second or third richest men in the world. And, you know, he's just a remarkable guy. And, you know, really exemplifies for me stability. How does this guy who, you know, simple suits, you know, he loves to play music, by the way. He plays the uke or the banjo. I think it's the banjo he plays. But here he is, a simple man. And just to give you a couple of things that have happened to him, a Chinese investor paid $2.1 million just to eat lunch with him. You know, they say if you want to be successful, buy a millionaire lunch. Well, this Chinese investor paid $2.1 million to eat lunch with Warren Buffett, and that was just so he could pick his brain, right? And he also made $36 billion, the largest charitable donation in history, And of course, like I mentioned, he was like one of the top three richest men in the world. And one of Warren Buffett's quotes that I love, he says, it's better to hang out with people better than you. Pick out associates whose behavior is better than yours, and you'll drift in that direction. I'll say that again for you. It's better to hang out with people that are better than you. Pick out associates whose behavior is better than yours, and you'll drift in that direction. So, you know, that's a biggie, hey? The big one there is stability. And another one is trust. So I'll give you a clue again. We're going to go through this game a few times to see if you can guess. So born into poverty to a teenage single mother and raised in an inner city. This is the person I think when I think of trust. Born into poverty to a teenage single mother and raised in an inner city. She was raped at the age of 9, ran away from home at 13, and became pregnant at 14. All right? Anyone guessing? Yeah, Oprah Winfrey. She's built so much trust. And when we look at it, so what I'm saying here, if we want to create these parts of leadership in ourselves, in our company, in our homes, in our kids, you know, we just model a little bit of what these people do because they're everywhere. You can see them, and you can see how they speak. It's easy to model success, right? Anyway, Oprah, this is a few years old now, but her yearly income was $275 million. I don't know what that works out to be a minute, but it's a lot. She was the first black woman billionaire in history. She has a net worth of over $3 billion. The richest self-made woman in America. And the world's, listen to this, built on trust. You know, she builds this trust. And what is it about her thing, right? She's so authentic. I think that what created her success, here she is. You know, she was raped, ran away from home in a city. A lot of reasons not to not succeed. And I know that a lot of women I speak to who have gone through any kind of abuse or anything happened to them, you know, there is that choice of choosing to use that as a springboard into something great or carrying it as a burden. But I mean, forgiveness is the big key there. We can talk about that at another show. But she's now considered to be the world's most influential person. Imagine this. A black woman from the inner cities has become the world's most influential person by building trust. By being honest, I mean, she sits in front of her audience and she says it as it is. You know, she has weight issues. She has other issues. She's just a human being doing the best she can. One of her quotes I like, she says, real integrity is doing the right thing knowing that no one's going to know whether you did it or not. Real integrity is doing the right thing, knowing that nobody's going to know whether you did it or not. Another big one, truth. Let's talk about truth, all right? So, again, by the way, there were four in the survey, and some of these I've added. So I've added a couple of others that I feel are really critical for myself. So, and you can probably define them. And it's easy. If you put in the Gallup poll on leadership, of 10,000 people. You can read that, your whole study, if you want. Okay. This person was married at age of 13, became a father at 15, so it's a guy, married at 13, became a father at 15, after being thrown from a train and experiencing beatings, imprisonment, and other hardship, he adopted his methodology of devotion to truth. That's why I chose him. He died penniless. Now, this has been one of my own big journeys. I say that the hardest thing I had to learn was to be honest. I lied my whole life. I was always attempting to I was a prover. I didn't want people to know my truth. So I hid behind a lie the whole time, my whole life. It took me years and years and years and years and years. I mean, I was a 40-odd before I really started to learn how to tell the truth. So I sort of coined this phrase, my 8 most powerful words. Tell the truth all the time with compassion. Tell the truth all the time with compassion, my 8 most favorite words. And you know, it's that whole idea then, and I have to stumble across that all the time. But this devotion to truth is why this person's one of my heroes. And have you guessed who it is? Mahatma Gandhi. Yeah, Mahatma Gandhi. Very simple. I love his story. If you don't get into his story, watch the movie. You know, because here he is, a lawyer in South Africa dealing with the worst kind of persecution, thrown from a train. And he goes back and frees his nation by using what? A loincloth and a spinning wheel where he wove his own fabric. And he, you know, starved himself, what, 3 or 4 times to stop people fighting the English. But, you know, he got the country freed, right? And he couldn't boast any scientific achievement. He had no artistic gift. Yet men, governments, dignitaries from all over the world have joined hands to pay homage to him. This is actually a quote from General George C. Marshall. He says, he could not boast any scientific achievement or artistic gift, yet men, governments, and dignitaries from all over the world have joined hands today to pay homage to this little brown man in a loincloth who led his country to freedom. These are the words of General George C. Marshall, the American Secretary of State. He says, Mahatma Gandhi has become the spokesman for the consciousness of all mankind. He was a man who made humility and simple truth more powerful than empires. Listen to that. He's a man who made humility and more simple and simple truth more powerful than empires. So that's one of those great things we can practice. Practicing truth is takes such courage, you know, and you deal with it every single day. Do you tell the truth or do you tell a lie? Do you tell people what they want to hear or do you tell them what they need to hear? You know, that happened to me yesterday. It's really interesting on this podcast because I launched the first one, and because it's all new equipment, I'm dialing knobs and, you know, and I was totally disconnected the first solo podcast I did. And I actually posted it on the site and asked a few friends before we launched it to have a listen to it. And everyone said, oh, it's great, blah, 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 blah. And then my close friend Mike, he finally said, I got to tell you, that doesn't sound like you at all. You sound disconnected. I know those stories and it doesn't sound interesting like you did. And it's like, I said, wow. And I phoned another friend of mine who told me it was great. I said, buddy, I said, next time tell me the truth. He said, yeah, I'm sorry. I said, I didn't want to hurt your feelings. I said, you can't hurt my feelings. That's what I live for is the truth. So within an hour, I had a new one recorded. I felt great about it. It was completely connected because now I knew the equipment. I was playing with the knobs differently. I wasn't so distracted. And, you know, I mean, it's a new muscle. But it took some truth and someone I love and care about, my business partner, Mike Schmidt. And thank you, Mike. I know you're going to be listening to these, so thank you so much. I said to him, I said, I think I've mentioned you in every podcast so far. But let's talk about Gandhi. He held no office, pursued no career, accumulated no wealth, and desired no fame. Yet billions of people in India and around the world have been influenced by his life and his achievements. He was an honest seeker of truth, a fearless defender of the weak, and an uncompromising practitioner of nonviolence. And listen to this, he was nominated 5 times for the Nobel Peace Prize. And the only reason, the year he was shot, he would have won the Nobel Peace Prize, but because he had no estate, he didn't have a wealth plan, he had no money, they felt, because it was $1 million prize with the Nobel Peace Prize, and so they didn't give it to him, he never won it. Because they were afraid that it would create so much chaos and you know, because who was going to get the money? How would it be distributed? Because Gandhi was dead, he was shot that year. So that's why he never won it, but 5 times nominated. A great quote from him that I like is, a nation's culture resides in the hearts and the soul of its people. I love that because, you know, I'm all about building culture in my own community, and a nation's culture resides in the hearts and the soul of its people. And I really do believe that. Wonderful. Another big one is compassion. Compassion for me. Again, listen to these things. They're not about, you know, goal setting and strategic planning. And not that they're important. They're important as well. But the human elements are what's going to get, you know, people following. There's that great saying. I love it. You can't lead the cavalry if you think you look funny on a horse. You know what so many people do? They don't feel they want to lead because they think they don't believe in themselves, right? But we're all leading someone. I think just by our very, I would say you can, leadership is how you walk through the streets. You know, you can change whole mindsets just by how you behave around people. They see something in you they want. So this next one's compassion. All right, let me give you a clue. She decided at the age of 12 to dedicate her life to a higher calling. At age 36, she was living on the streets begging for food for herself and others in need. A year later, she became clear on her mission. Here's her mission. You're probably going to give it away right now. To care for the hungry, the naked, the homeless, the crippled, the blind, the lepers. All those people who feel unwanted, unloved, uncared for throughout society. People that have become a burden to society and shunned by everyone. So, any guesses? Yeah, the Blessed Teresa of Calcutta, Mother Teresa. What was interesting for her, right, is that she was probably the only person in the world that can go into any head of state, any government in the world, whether they were fighting, it could be a Muslim, it could be anywhere, that she had access to every head of state in the world, unlike any other human being. So anyway, so her her thing was airports, roads, museums, monuments named after her. Over 1 million people work for her missions, and she's been nominated for sainthood. Imagine that, given the title of blessed for her work. And in 1979, she won the Nobel Peace Prize. So here's one of her quotes that I love. She says, "It is not how much we do, but how much love we put into the doing. It's not how much we give, but how much love we put into the giving." So, and the next one is forgiveness. Forgiveness is it's a biggie. I feel this is I practice immediate forgiveness. I don't want to hold on to anything. They say holding on to anger is like drinking poison and expecting somebody else to die. Holding on to resentment, holding on to anything is like drinking poison and expecting someone else to die. So forgiveness is something that is a practice. And when we practice, it doesn't matter what's happened to you. It could be the worst thing. It can, doesn't matter. Just, hey, you're not forgiving them just for them. You're forgiving them for you to clean yourself. There's not this burden you walk around with. I can see some people, something happened in their life. Like we talked about with Oprah. You know, I mean, she was raped at the age of 9. She could have been around with this heavy burden on her life the whole of her life. She didn't. She turned it around and, you know, and she's changed the world. And she has such a huge impact on her own journey and has invited millions and millions of people to join her. Anyway, this person was a victim of extreme racism, persecution and hatred, became a commander of an armed resistance, led bombing raids, sabotage campaigns against the military and the governments, and spent 27 years in prison. Okay, President Nelson Mandela. I mean, what a guy. Imagine this. I mean, Mandela, all those 27 years in prison. If you've been to, I remember when I was in South Africa, I was there, my buddy Guy Chaston. Guy, I know you listen to these too. Hi. but, you know, my buddy, you know, when I was there with him, and he was living in Nuduk in Cape Town, but we went on a trip through South Africa in his motorhome, and before I left him, and I went up through Zimbabwe, Zambia, and Botswana on my own. But I remember going to Johannesburg and feeling for the first time absolutely terrified. I was terrified because I was white, and there was just so much happening. You didn't have to stop at this after dusk. You didn't have to stop at traffic lights, you know, because there were so many abductions and you know, gang attacks on cars and all these kind of things. You know, I didn't meet anyone who was white, hadn't been stabbed or shot or something. One of a family member killed. I mean, it was incredible. And I don't think a lot of white people understand what it's like to feel persecution like that. And certainly that's where I felt it there. It's one of the very few places I was scared and wanted to get out of there. I saw no reason to stay there. You know, I find it crazy that people live there, but it's, you know, obviously people love it, but, you know, every home has, you know, barbed wire and dogs and security systems, and, you know, you live in a different kind of mindset, right? But the Mandela Day, adopted by the United Nations, individuals, communities, and organizations are asked to donate 67 minutes annually to doing something good for others. So imagine this, the Mandela Day, people are asking 67 minutes annually for doing something good for others, commemorating the 67 years that Nelson Mandela gave to the struggle for social justice. It's great, right? And he became the country's first black president with 62% of the vote. He's won 250 major global awards. And in 1993, he won the Nobel Peace Prize. And one of his great sayings, he says, "Forgiveness always seems impossible until it's done." And that's one of the great things. I really love that. It's, I have the choice. You know, it always seems impossible until it's done. You know, but how do you practice forgiveness? Just do it. Forgive someone and try it. Next one is servitude. And this person formally became the ruler of his own country at age 15, fled his country in 1959 and set up the government in exile. He's still in exile today. Now, this guy, I'm going to tell a whole story about him on another podcast, but he's become one of the more influential people on how I train about authenticity. And I remember, I'll tell you a little sneak at that. When I went to see him, we were in a little field in Idaho, in Haley, Idaho. That's where Bruce Willis and Demi Moore have, they own that little town. It's only a town of like 8,000 people. So to see the Dalai Lama, and I'm sitting like 8 feet from his feet as he's doing this kind of this address. But I'll tell you that story another day. But this is the servitude, to be a servant. And I think that this is easy to do. And I think great leaders are great servants. And I mean, one of my great heroes, Richard Branson, if you fly Virgin and he's on the plane, he's going to serve the tea. I've heard stories of him standing at the bottom of the ladder as people get off the stairway in the pouring rain without an umbrella, shaking people's hands and thanking them. But a real servant mentality. He's an author. This is the Dalai Lama, author, lecturer, and spiritual leader, a global humanitarian, and a symbol of peace, compassion, tolerance, and contentment. Listen to that. A symbol of peace, compassion, tolerance, and contentment. And in 1989, he won the Nobel Peace Prize as well. Here's a great quote of his. He says, "It is necessary to help others, but not only in our prayers, but in our daily lives. It is necessary to help others, not only in our prayers, but in our daily lives. If we find we cannot help others, the least we can do is to desist from harming them. If we find that we cannot help others, the least we can do is to desist from harming them." So this next one is unshakable belief. This isn't one of the four, but I think this is just unbelievably important. And everything I teach right now, I realize that certainty, this is an uncertain world, and people are looking for certainty, something that they can see in someone else's eyes. It doesn't matter what you do. You can be a poet like my sister, Melody. I'm sure you're listening. Hi, Melody. But it can be someone, as long as you're certain on your path, then there's going to be people that want to follow you. And I think it's all about, you know, I follow people and people follow me. And with my certainty, more people want to follow my certainty. And it doesn't matter which, in which area it is. But this unshakable belief, something you're willing to die for, is very rare today. But this guy, he became a pastor at the age of 25. His home was bombed and life was constantly threatened. After visiting India, he was inspired by Gandhi. Listen to this. That he adopted a nonviolent approach to social change. So Gandhi is in India. He's got a nonviolent approach to social change. And this guy sees it and says, "I can do the same thing." He says, this is what he says, "All I'm saying is simply this, that all life is interrelated, that somehow we're caught in an inescapable network of mutuality tied in a single garment of destiny." So what a beautiful thing. He says, "All I'm saying is simply this, that all life is interrelated, that somehow we're caught in an inescapable network of mutuality." Try and say that with these new teeth. "Tied in a single garment of destiny. Whatever affects one directly affects all indirectly. For some strange reason, I can never be what I ought to be until you are what you ought to be. You can never be what you ought to be until I am what I ought to be. This is the interrelated structure of reality." That's what he said. What a great guy. He died for his beliefs. You know what it is? Unshakable belief? Yeah. Dr. Martin Luther King. Unbelievable. On one of the podcasts, I'll play you I Have a Dream, a part of it. I Have a Dream, or his final speech. I use it a lot in my teachings. And I really have so much respect for this guy. He's the first African-American honored with his own memorial in the National Mall area, and the first non-president to be commemorated in such a way. So here he is, after struggling, being shot, you know, these years later, he's one of the first African-American in the National Mall, and the first non-president to be commemorated in that way. President Ronald Reagan signed a bill creating a federal holiday called the Martin Luther King Day. He's received hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of prestigious awards. There's 720 cities in the U.S. that have streets named after him, and voted most widely admired person of the 20th century. And he won the Nobel Peace Prize in 64. And that is what I'm saying, these uncommon things of leadership. Excuse me. One of his quotes, "I have a dream that my four little children will one day live in a nation where they will not be judged by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character." I have a dream. You gotta watch that. You can go on YouTube and find it too. Fun. This one here, this isn't one of the four. It's the four, by the way, stability, compassion, truth, okay? Stability, compassion, and truth. And I'll tell you the last one last. But fun is one I've added, because I think that great leaders have the ability to make it fun. This guy had dyslexia and had poor academic performance. He sold records out of the boot of his car. He lived on a barge or a boathouse. He says, "My interest in life comes from setting myself huge, apparently unachievable challenges and trying to rise above them. From the perspective of wanting to live life to the full, I felt I had to attempt it." This is a kick-ass guy. This is one of my superheroes. He's a superhero for me. You guess who it is? Sir Richard Branson. He's done everything. He's in the Guinness Book of World Records. He's a multi-billionaire. I want to go to space with this guy and in his program, Virgin Galactica. Unbelievable human being. I just love this guy. Anyway, airlines, railways, space, travel, music industry, phone industry, fuels, everything. He's in everything. And he's always like like David and Goliath. He's the little guy that's going to fight the big guy. He's a multi-billionaire, a philanthropist, and a multiple Guinness World Record holder. Here's one of his quotes. I love this. He says, "With the casinos and the beds, our passengers will have at least two ways to get lucky on one of our flights." Ready? He says, "With the casinos and the beds, our passengers will have at least two ways to get lucky on one of our flights." And the last one, this is one of the four, was hope, delivering hope. And, you know, to become an ambassador of hope, I think, is true leadership. You know, he says, hope is not a dream, but a way of making dreams become a reality. And, you know, this idea that we can instill hope in others just by our being is so important. So that's a little look at four attributes of leadership and a few others I threw in. Before I close up, I want to answer the question. Sue Field, she asked on Facebook, she said, and by the way, my Facebook page is, you can go to David Wood Training, or David T.S. Wood is my personal page. And then David Wood Training is my other page, all right? So yeah, come and meet me there. Just push like. But she said, "When you say accept all offers, is there ever one you refuse? Just asking." Well, Sue, and the reason she said that, she was at one of my programs where the whole program is structured around resistance equaling pain. So if you're in pain about anything in your life, it's pretty much because you're resisting what's really happening. The universe, it doesn't matter, you know. I mean, you think of people like, what's his name now? The Man in Motion. I've forgotten his name, but, you know, I mean, he broke his back and when he was hitchhiking in the back of a car. And guess what? He went on to become the Man in Motion and wheeled his wheelchair around the world. Rick Hansen. And, you know, I just say that we have this incredible capacity to, if we accept what happens to us. And I often think about this. I think, you know, in my body right now, there's not a chance I'd be in the Olympics. But if I was a quadriplegic or a paraplegic, or I mean, if I lost a leg, there's a good chance I could compete in the Olympics. But I think about those things. I think, you know, how am I going to be if something happens? How will I be tomorrow if I wake up and I'm in a car accident today and I lose my legs? I want to wake up the minute I wake up. I want to wake up with this positive attitude. And I remember a story. We were at an art show in Vernon. I was there with the kids. And I was like standing, and I collect art, but I was standing about 35 feet away from this guy, and I saw him sitting behind a table. And I could see in his eyes something interesting. So I wander over there, and he carves out a soapstone. And I realize he's in a wheelchair. His wife's there and his son sitting to one side. And we get chatting, and I asked him, you know, what's going on, what happened, blah, blah, blah. And he had a photo album there of his journey. And what happened was he had this accident, broke his back. He was a kind of a competitive elite athlete and in, you know, extreme sports, broke his back. And his wife was showing that some of the photographs when he came out of surgery and everything else like that, he looked like he'd come from a concentration camp. He had no muscle on his bones. He got infected three or four times where he almost died. But then he started working out and he's ripped. And now he does extreme sports. He does these crazy things on snowmobiles and everything because he doesn't need his legs. And, you know, this photograph of him flying through the air with his legs dangling behind him. But he's got this massive upper body strength. And she said to me, she said, you know, the day he opened his eyes, he was never once said a negative word. He never once said anything negative. So what I look at accepting all offers. It doesn't matter what's going on. I mean, so everyone, I ask people this question all the time. I say, so how many of you agree that the universe is on purpose? And people always put up their hands, you know, in hundreds. I have 6,000 people in the room and 10,000 people. They go, yeah, we agree the universe is on purpose. Great. You know, so we agree the universe is on purpose. And some people, that if you want to turn the universe word into a God or Buddha, Allah, whatever your faith is, however you express your faith. So if you believe the God's on purpose or Buddha's on purpose or Allah's on purpose, however you express it, I use the word as universe and you turn it into what you need it to be for your faith. Then if we agree that everything's happening for a reason and should be happening or is happening the way it is and should happen for a reason the way it is, then why is it that when things happen, we resist them? I mean, you're in a car accident. I mean, I've watched this so often. It's so funny. You know, people getting these little fender benders, they get out, they're all angry and swearing. It's like, there's a fender bender. Who cares, right? But we have a choice. So I what I teach around this program is that when we accept all offers from the universe, we stop the pain. We stop living in pain. We stop resisting what's really happening. So there's something happens. So I said, you know, do you accept that, you know, universe on purpose? Yeah, okay. So here's this incident happens, right? You lose your legs, right? You lose a leg in an accident. That's the situation. Situation happens. It's going to happen, so it happens, right? It could be a car accident. It could be anything, right? Your kid tells you to get lost in the worst possible way, right? So whatever happens, there's the incident. There's the situation. Now we arrive at the situation and we make it into something. So if we, situation is, there's a car accident. We come to that car accident and we can get out. And this has happened to me. I've been hit a couple of times from behind, right? Get out, smile, understand that it happens to everyone. Even if it's their fault, we all make mistakes. You know, this one guy hit me with a cement truck. My kids were in the back of the car. He was smoking a cigarette. A lot of reasons why I could have got angry and told him, like, you, whatever. I didn't. Because I realized the situation's already happened. Now, what I do with it is really up to me. And so, you know, Sue's question is, when you accept all offers, is there ever one you refuse? No, there's not an offer you refuse to accept. You have to accept it. Now, if the offer is, and Sue, you know, I know that you have a child who is severely handicapped. I'm not sure if that's the right way of saying it, so excuse me if I'm using the wrong term. And so, you know, accepting that offer, she's beautiful. And I know how you talk about it with such reverence, having twins, you know, and your love of her is evident in what you say. You know, you accept the offer. You can't spend your life wishing it was different from what it is. It's what it is. So you don't refuse to accept the offer. Now, how you deal with it could be differently. So you could accept the offer if you're with someone who's a real jerk off and a real ass to you, you know, and whatever. I don't know. I'm not talking about you, Sue, because I know your husband. He's gorgeous. But the idea, though, is that, yeah, you can accept the offer. That's part of it. Now, it doesn't mean you can't change what's going on. You can't make decisions to move out of it. But you don't have to resist it, wishing it was different from what it is. It is what it is. We can't change that. But we can change how we are. And what I found quite often is when I change, when I stay consistent, and I don't always do this with my kids. You know, I don't know. They can get right inside of me and I can get like to be a real idiot. But in most cases, you know, accepting what really is happening instead of wishing it was differently. It creates a life, I think, that is more powerful, real kick-ass. This is a kick-ass idea that whatever happens to us, we accept. If you wake up one morning and you're paralyzed, you know, how do you open up your eyes from the moment you open your eyes and start living more beautifully, more openly, more connectedly, squeezing the juice out of every second, knowing from the second you open your eyes that you're going to recover and become the best paraplegic in the entire world, doing the most incredible things. I remember I did a triathlon a few years ago, and the guy next to me had no legs. He was cut right, really super high. And you know, his time was like a minute and a half slower than me. So he has to swim with his arms. When he gets out and he does his bike, he actually pedals with his hands. He sits on a different wheelchair where he pedals. And the run, he wheels with normal, like a normal speed running wheelchair. But I mean, he does the whole thing with his arms, and we're about a minute apart. I mean, it's crazy. And he loves life, you know, we accept all offers, Sue. It's not one's, and if we refuse to accept one of what's really happening, then we're going to be in pain and resist. And as soon as we resist, say this with me, resistance equals pain. So that's the deal. Now, I'm not saying you have to stay with it. I don't say you can't make great choices about it. So there we are. You know, I think we're coming to the end of this one. And I want to say how awesome this has been. And I'm looking forward, so looking forward to connecting with you soon and bring in some awesome guests. We've got some great people, can't believe it, you know, and I want you to go out there and start thinking about how you want to lead a kick-ass life and what you can bring. Remember the poem, you know, let your light shine and you unconsciously give others permission to do the same. Having so much fun hanging out with you. And I will see you shortly. And don't forget my son's last words.
That was kick ass.